Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR. And starting today, ladies and gentlemen, we're also podcasting from the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can listen to the program any time of day. And this site is made possible by Dotfoil Computer Services right here in Santa Fe on the web at dotfoil.com. That's dotfoil.com. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Carolyn Fairman about the Coffee Kids. Right now, I'd like to welcome Danny Katzman. He is a geologist at Los Alamos National Laboratories, where he is program manager in the Water Stewardship Program and project leader in the Chromium Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Now, our subject tonight, it precedes a public meeting on Wednesday at Los Alamos called the Groundwater Update at Fuller Lodge. That's this coming Wednesday night at 5:30, and we'll be talking more about that. But the subject is chromium contamination in the groundwater. Chromium is known as a toxin. How did chromium get into the groundwater around Los Alamos?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for inviting me to be here to discuss this. Chromium actually gets into the groundwater at Los Alamos in a number of ways. There's operations throughout the laboratory, primarily back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, that used chromium in various plating processes. And but most importantly, the chromium that we're dealing with now is associated with its use as a corrosion inhibitor in power plants. And it actually keeps closed-loop water systems from scaling and operating functionally.
And so it's used in those processes. It's not being released into the atmosphere, into the local water systems anymore. Is that correct?
No, that's correct. The chromium was released back in the 50s and 60s, some did actually get released into the air through stacks. Most of it was released in what's called outfalls. It was actually, interestingly enough, early perspectives on some of the potential health effects associated with chromium, even in the 70s, that caused them to stop using it. And as far as we can tell in our archival research, it appears that the chromium that was released, which was as a form called hexavalent chromium, ceased being released in about 1972.
So what was the path of the chromium when it left Los Alamos? I mean, it was dumped as part of liquid. It was dumped in water into a canyon?
That's correct. At Los Alamos, I think people are generally familiar here locally with the geography there. There's mesas and canyons. And in this particular case, the chromium that we're investigating now was actually released from a relatively large power plant that was operational in the very early days of the laboratory, and something on the order of about 200,000 gallons of water per day were released from the power plant, from the cooling tower system, and it contained something on the order of about 35 to 40 pounds of chromium in that 200,000 gallons released
every day.
That's
a lot of chromium.
That is a lot of chromium.
Over a period of, what, 20 years or so?
About 20 years. Again, it's a little hard to pin down the exact details, but it appears that the chromium was released from approximately 1956 to about 1972.
So you have a sense of the total amount that should exist somewhere in the vicinity of Los Alamos. So what was its path? How did it travel? How far has it gone?
Okay, well, the effluent, as it's called, that was released from this power plant actually creates, in this particular canyon, this is a canyon called Sandia Canyon, actually created a stream, and we describe that term as an effluent-supported stream that created continuous surface water flow for maybe about 4 miles down the canyon.
So a stream wouldn't have been there otherwise except for this effluent?
That's correct. Okay. It could be that there would have been, in the early days of the laboratory, small springs. There are springs located throughout the laboratory property, and but they certainly wouldn't have created a substantial stream. So the stream literally was an effluent-supported stream. And it appears that the stream was continuously flowing from the power plant, which is way up at the head of the canyon, the very far west end of the laboratory, and continued as a continuous surface flow for about 4 miles, where the stream channel and the sediment below the stream channel really starts thickening up, gets very thick, maybe on the order of 30 to 40 feet, and the stream soaks into the sediment down in that area.
So first it goes along the surface, which is not porous, then it hits an area where there's a lot of sediment, it's porous, the water soaks into the ground, including the chromium.
Including the chromium.
Where does it go from there?
Well, backing up just a little bit, from the point of the release, the surface water that contains the chromium in it certainly encounters features along the way that could cause some of the chromium to bind or stay in place. And in the upper part of Sandia Canyon, in fact, very close to the release site itself, is a wetland. It's a fairly large wetland. It's somewhere between about a half kilometer and maybe three quarters of a kilometer long. And that wetland contains, of course, like all wetlands, a large amount of organic material. And our records indicate, and early photos indicate, that wetland did exist to some degree at the time of the releases of chromium. And so some of that chromium would have started binding along this 4 mile or so surface water pathway, partially in the wetland. And then some of it clearly escaped that area and continued on down. And in this location, maybe about 4 miles downstream that we were describing, the chromium, as you pointed out, encounters more porous materials at depth in the geologic layers and starts soaking downward.
We're talking to Danny Katzman, geologist at Los Alamos National Laboratories, about chromium contamination in the local water. Now, it filters downwards. It then goes, what, straight into the aquifer? Does it take a path to get there?
Well, in this particular location in Sandia Canyon, there's a pretty complex hydrologic setting. There's the surface water, as we described. There's what we call an alluvial groundwater body, which is only about 30 feet down, and it's maybe 6 to 10 feet thick. So there's another perched groundwater body there, about 30 feet down. And then you start encountering a very complex geologic layering beneath that. And so the water infiltrates, kind of percolates very slowly through those layers, starts encountering other tighter, more less porous rocks at depth, and might perch again, creating another groundwater body, in this case maybe 350 feet down. Very thin, maybe on the order of 10 feet or so thick. Not necessarily continuous in a lateral sense, but locally kind of perched water, where it then starts finally working its way back through that layer down to around 800 feet, which is to the zone that we call our regional aquifer. It's the main drinking water supply for Los Alamos County. It's the main water supply for the laboratory as well. And so that groundwater body, certainly the one that we're most interested in with respect to the chromium, is at about 800 feet below the ground surface.
Now, how do you figure all of this out? When you talk about a type of contamination, a lot of people use the word plume. So there is a plume of chromium that, and what does that mean in terms of shape? What does that mean in terms of the front of it, the back of it? And how do you know how big that plume is?
That's a good question. It's largely derived from direct observations from monitoring wells. I mean, you can model the plume. You can do all kinds of things with kind of numerical modeling and using math and assumptions about how things move. And
but really, you got to dig a hole in the ground.
Yeah, and that is done. We do the modeling. It's an important way to see if you can essentially mathematically replicate direct observations in the field. And if you can, then you can start using the model to predict what the fate is going to be. But it's about drilling holes. Sometimes core samples are collected from the holes, where you actually get samples of the rocks and sediments that you encounter down to 400 feet or so. And you can send those samples off to an analytical laboratory who sends back results with values for chromium and anything else you might be interested in. And then groundwater monitoring wells are placed in all three of those water zones that we've described earlier. And samples are collected from those as well.
Now, this chromium has been going from Los Alamos into the groundwater, into the surface water, the groundwater, and so on, for a good 50 years. How do you know, are you sure how far it's gone? Could it have gone to, Mexico, Arizona, Texas, or is it just in this local area?
Well, it's certainly still in the local area. I mean, groundwater environments typically have recharge locations, and we're actually describing one of them now. This is a non-natural recharge that we've created with this effluent where it soaks in, but there's also natural recharge areas, typically along mountain fronts. But there's also discharge locations, and in this case, the groundwater in the aquifer beneath Los Alamos generally discharges along White Rock Canyon into the Rio Grande.
Now, is there chromium that has been found in the Rio Grande? Have you looked there?
We have looked, and to date, we've not measured chromium concentrations that look different from background. I think it's important to kind of point out as a frame of reference here that there is naturally occurring chromium in groundwaters all over the world, and at Los Alamos as well. And we've been measuring the springs that represent the discharge of the deep groundwater into the Rio Grande. It's expressed as springs all along White Rock Canyon. And we've been measuring that for decades, and no chromium has shown above background at those locations to date.
Well, and then here's the big question, is it in the drinking water, and how close is it to the drinking water?
Yeah, that's of course the most paramount question of all. And it's certainly these concentrations that we found here are in the same aquifer that the drinking water is from, and it has not been seen at concentrations above background in any of the water supply wells that are actually, all the water supply wells in the system there is owned by Los Alamos County. Some of the wells, though, happen to be within the laboratory property itself. So that's, of course, an issue and something we watch very closely, but we're doing quarterly monitoring for very comprehensive analyses at all of the water supply wells, and so far haven't seen any concentrations that look different from background.
Now, how close is the chromium that you have monitored in high concentrations?
Yeah, we've monitored, we have a location that we call monitoring well R28, and it's showing the highest concentrations that we've seen of all the wells. It's the highest. The concentrations there are between about 300 and 400 parts per billion, and it's about 3/4 of a mile up gradient, so up the groundwater flow direction from a nearby water supply well.
So it could flow downhill to the groundwater?
It absolutely could.
Now, let's keep in mind, 3 or 400 parts per billion is a lot higher than the legal limit of 50 parts per billion, the
That's
EPA
correct.
Set limit.
That's correct.
So that's a significant amount of chromium.
That is a significant amount of chromium. And it's certainly one of the reasons why the laboratory is taking this so seriously, and so is the State Environment Department, who is our regulator on this work. And there has been a considerable acceleration of the work and the investigations and kind of all of the regulatory steps that are normally done on investigations. That's been accelerated really by both parties in a very aggressive way to kind of get at a quick answer to whether or not this is a significant problem, and if so, what can be done about it.
Now let's step back for a moment, and we're not going to have a major chemistry class here on the radio, but I think it's important to talk about the fact that chromium is an element on the periodic table, but it does not appear as pure elemental chromium. It appears as a compound. Some chromium is found in your vitamin pills. That's the good kind of chromium. The chromium that's dissolved in the groundwater is a toxic kind of chromium.
That's correct.
What's the difference, and how do they get the way they are, the healthy kind and the toxic kind?
Well, the those are typically referred to, the one that's considered an essential nutrient is a trivalent chromium, otherwise known as chromium-3. Both types of chromium are generally found as chromium oxides, so they're complexed with hydrogen and oxygen. And I'm certainly not a geochemist, and so I hope you don't ask me too much detail about this. But the chromium that was released is released as a compound called chromate, and it's in the hexavalent or chrome 6 phase, so it is the more toxic of the two. And in the environment, hexavalent chromium, particularly in the presence of oxygen, is pretty typically, and in the presence of organic matter, pretty typically quickly converted to the trivalent and stable, less toxic, and essentially non-mobile form. And
so chromium comes out of the cooling water, cooling towers, it goes into the canyon, it hits a bunch of dirt and grass and the wetland you were talking about, and it turns into vitamins.
It turns into a vitamin mine. But some of that, and it becomes essentially relatively benign in the environment at that point.
But then some of it doesn't get absorbed, some of it keeps going, and that's the stuff that you're worried about.
That's correct. And in the groundwater at Los Alamos, it's relatively stable as the hexavalent form and highly mobile and essentially moves close to at the same rate that the water itself moves.
So in terms of sticking with the two different kinds of chromium for a second, in terms of remediation of this situation, is there a way to, on purpose, as a scientist, transform the bad kind of chromium, the chromium 6, into the benign chromium 3 form?
There is, actually, and that's maybe one of the fortunate things that we'll have going for us if it comes to that in this project, is that chromium is quite treatable. It's what makes it a little bit difficult is in deep groundwater environments, certainly 800 to 1,000 feet below the ground, you can only know so much about how things are behaving. And you have points where you're evaluating it in monitoring wells, but you really have this kind of mystery zone in between where you don't really quite know what's happening in between. So,
yeah, because you can't dig an infinite number of wells.
Exactly. And so what's called in situ treatment, meaning treating the chromium problem in the groundwater itself, can be very complex for that reason. The technologies are there, but it just has inherent uncertainty associated with it. Some of the technologies involve injecting certain chemicals into the groundwater itself through maybe injection wells that might not look different from the monitoring wells themselves, and then making some assumptions about that injected chemical working its way through the aquifer, encountering the chromium plume, and converting it. So that has been done at some facilities, typically where groundwater is much, much shallower than our situation here at Los Alamos. But again, you're also left with a couple of uncertainties. How well did my injected chemical make it between all my injection points? And also, it leaves the uncertainty of long-term stability of that situation. You don't want to remediate a situation and have uncertainty as to whether or not, if you walk away 30 years from then, some kind of geochemical change occurs that makes the chromium go back into the hexavalent and mobile form. So you have to be very careful about that. Above ground treatment is actually quite straightforward and is done at places all over the country. So one option might be, for instance, to withdraw the groundwater from the ground and treat it at the surface before you reapply it to the delivery system itself. And that's actually very straightforward technology.
Why wouldn't you just treat it at the site of the drinking water supply?
You absolutely could. Yeah, you would probably want to treat it before it got too far into the system. And a lot of it depends also on the nature of your water supply system. Some wells might not mix with others. They might be kept that water stream might be kept separate for certain communities and things like that. I know, for instance, in Santa Fe, some of the wells here produce uranium concentrations that are actually in exceedance of the EPA standards.
And that's naturally occurring uranium?
It's naturally occurring uranium. And the city deals with that by mixing the higher concentration water with low concentration water from other wells and end up delivering to the users concentrations that are below the standards.
So that's rather than trying to take out the uranium because that's too hard.
That's correct. Well, yeah, it might be ultimately. It's always kind of a trade-off between the cost and the benefits associated with those kinds of things.
We're talking to geologist Danny Katzman, who is with Los Alamos National Laboratory Water Stewardship Program. Let's talk about those wetlands that are nearby. As you mentioned, wetlands, which are full of organic matter, tend to absorb chromium, immobilize it, convert it to a more benign form. Do you expect, have you checked out those wetlands? Are they full of, you know, pounds or tons of chromium?
We've done some preliminary look at the concentrations of chromium in the wetland, and indications are that there is substantial chromium there. There are special tests that can be run to help you understand whether or not your chromium is as the benign version that we're describing here, chromium 3, or as the hexavalent. We've done those tests, and it's turning out it is all chromium 3. So there are some indications that a potentially substantial amount, maybe tons of chromium, still sits within that wetland. And that's the subject of a very intensive investigation that we've actually begun just here in the last couple of weeks.
Now, that will be going on through the summer. Do you know from looking at other environments or reading about other environments where things like this have happened, whether that much chromium in a wetland affects the local wildlife?
Well, that's absolutely one of the things that we'll be investigating. Part of all of these investigations include ecological assessments. It's interesting to think that if the chromium 3, the trivalent chromium, is essentially benign for humans, that it might be the same for the wildlife. But we won't be making any assumptions about that. We'll be doing direct studies on various forms of wildlife that exist in the wetland. There's a substantial population of shrews and voles and birds, and even elk are commonly seen down in the wetland, especially in the morning. It's a great place to work, actually.
Now, as a scientist, you're trying to make a model of an incredibly complex, geologically complex system. How do you know how accurate you are? I mean, one of the things that you and I have talked about is that the drilling methods themselves have sometimes had created errors because some of the materials you use in drilling absorb chromium, so the numbers you get are not accurate.
Mm-hmm. Well, with respect to the monitoring wells themselves, there are ways by using by looking for indicators of what we were describing earlier as background conditions in the groundwater. We understand what those are, and we have a way of looking at those constituents of the groundwater in the monitoring wells that are part of an investigation like chromium, seeing how well they represent the background conditions of non-contaminant type constituents. And if those look like they're pretty reliable, then you make the leap that your contaminant data is also good, acknowledging that there are situations, in fact at the laboratory, where some of the residual effects of drilling have created some problems. But we'll factor that in absolutely as a part of the chromium investigation, and certainly not overrepresent data that could be problematic. But we believe that in the vicinity of the chromium investigation, the data that we're getting is quite reliable.
So what happens now? I mean, you're doing this public meeting on Wednesday night. It's called Groundwater Update at Fuller Lodge.
A creative title.
Well, it's a very scientific title. From 5:30 to 8:30, and people can show up. The point is just to simply inform the public of the stuff you're talking about right now?
Yeah, that's correct. The information on the Chromium Project has certainly been out in a number of forums. It's been in the paper quite a bit, certainly in the Los Alamos Monitor, one of the local papers there, and even here in the Santa Fe papers. But this is really an attempt to kind of create a more open public forum that's very exchange-oriented, very interactive. And we're holding it intentionally this time in Los Alamos, where the people who are drinking water from that particular aquifer have an opportunity to hear firsthand what where we're at with our investigations, what the issues are. And the first part of the meeting is actually about an hour or so of kind of an open forum of poster session, as we call it, where we'll have graphical displays of a lot of this work up on easels, and we'll be around just to interact with people at that point, and then more just oral presentations after that. So,
have you done many presentations like this before? Did the public tend to show up?
You know, it's really quite variable. Sometimes you get remarkably good turnout, and other times not so much. And I don't know if that's about how it's advertised or whether people would rather be out in their gardens or what, but it's really, you never really know going into this. And we expect a decent turnout here, and hopefully people listening to the program here will be inspired to come and attend.
People have been concerned about this, I take it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have to assume so, although we don't get a barrage of calls from people, and certainly there are ways that people could contact us and seek more information about it. And we don't actually get calls from the community. And we work quite actively with the utilities managers in Los Alamos Canyon to make sure they're very aware of where we're at in our investigations. They own the water supply system, and it's ultimately their responsibility to communicate direct issues associated with the water supply system to the residents of the county.
Right.
And so far, again, because the concentrations haven't appeared different looking than background, they've felt... they have not been compelled to send out any kind of issues of concern.
Well, if you listeners would like to make a barrage of phone calls, the number is 667-0216 for more information about the groundwater update. Danny Katzman, thanks so much for being with us
on
the cafe.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thank you.
And once again, it's Wednesday night from 5:30 to 8:30 at Fuller Lodge, which is at 2132 Central Avenue in Los Alamos. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll be talking about the Coffee Kids. Stay tuned to KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten by Locals Care. Locals Care community cards reward you for shopping and dining at over 100 locally owned businesses. You can support a Santa Fe nonprofit and earn rewards for yourself at any Locals Care business. Find program information and a current list of participating businesses and nonprofits at locals-care.com. Offered in cooperation with the Santa Fe Alliance and sponsored by Century Bank, Los Alamos National Bank, the New Mexican, and the City of Santa Fe.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books, also a supporter of the Santa Fe Poet Laureate program. Here's a poem by Laureate Arthur Z.
The Owl. The path was purple in the dusk. I saw an owl perched on a branch, and when the owl stirred, the fine dust fell from its wings. I was silent then, and felt the owl quaver, and at dawn, waking, the path was green in the May light.
Notice anything? No more fun drive. We're done. We've made our goal, so back we go to regular programming. Hi, I'm Dal Dierman, General Manager of KSFR. On behalf of all of us at Santa Fe's only public radio, a big, big thank you to everyone. If you made your pledge by check, would you please send it on now to KSFR, Post Office Box 31366, Santa Fe 87594. If you're expecting a thank you gift, please allow 6 to 8 weeks for us to crank them all out. I'd like to say a special thank you to all our phone volunteers and to volunteer coordinator Angela Merkert, to Tim Pemberton, Sean Conlon, and Laurel Reynolds of our staff, to Linda Highheel, who bravely tackles all the details before, during, and after, and, of course, to Richard Block, KSFR Board President and Dean of the Drive. We are grateful to this unique community of ours and look forward to 6 months without saying that phone number once. Not once.
I'd like now to welcome Carolyn Fairman. She's Executive Director of Coffee Kids. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Coffee Kids is a local nonprofit organization that does work very far away. What is it? What do you do?
Well, we're an international nonprofit that works with coffee farming communities. Right now we're in primarily in Latin America. So what we do is work with communities by partnering with local nonprofit organizations in those regions, and we work with communities to find alternatives to coffee. The reason that we do that is because there's so much poverty associated with coffee farming. What most people don't realize is that most coffee farmers earn as little as 3 or 4 cents a pound for the coffee that they pick by hand. So what Coffee Kids does is listen to what community needs are and helps them implement projects that address quality of life issues. So our projects are really varied. Excuse me, I just need to take a breath. So our projects are really varied depending on what the communities see as their most pressing problem. So healthcare is a really important one. Education, so that students have more opportunities for their future. Microcredit, so women's community banking, so that women can take out small, low-interest loans and contribute to the family economy. And then community-based projects, things like chicken raising, organic vegetable gardening, things that provide food for the family and income by selling the extra, like, eggs or vegetables.
So basically, you go to people in, you know, Central America, South America, wherever. Is it mostly Latin America-based, or you also do stuff in Africa?
We are not currently in Africa. We're a pretty tiny nonprofit. Our budget is under $1 million, and so we started in Central America because our founder, who owns a coffee shop in Providence, Rhode Island, Bill Fishbein, went to Guatemala and saw firsthand what the poverty was like for coffee farmers. And when he returned, he just could not continue his business, which was quite successful, on the backs of people who were living in plastic tents. So it started in Guatemala and has sort of grown out in that way. That's why we're in Central America, Mexico, and now we're also in Peru.
And so you actually encourage people not to grow coffee.
No, actually that's not true at all.
Okay. And that's when you say alternatives to coffee growing, you mean so coffee and something else, or
right? Coffee is a culture for people, and we would never suggest that people change their culture or change their livelihood. But like most of us, we need alternatives or diversification in our lives. Coffee is harvested only about 3 to 5 months out of the year. So even if it were lucrative, which unfortunately it's not a year-round income. So people need supplemental incomes and they need year-round income. So a lot of these projects allow people to be able to do that, particularly the microcredit. It also allows women the opportunity to provide for the family economy, which in many of these regions is not as encouraged or as common.
Now, what are some of the actual things that people are doing with this microcredit? What are some of the alternatives?
Well, they'll start a local business, something that's needed in the area. They might make and sell tortillas. They might raise goats or chickens or pigs, and then they can sell them. And they might start a little hair salon was one of the things that was started because the kids needed haircuts when the school season started. So they're really varied depending on the local economy.
I've always wondered, you know, let's say that you are the Bill Fishbein, the director of Coffee Kids, who founded the whole thing. He goes at one point, sees that there's real problems, real poverty, and then shows up and says, I want to help you live differently. I mean, what is that? It seems like so much of this kind of work would be about relationship building. What are those relationships like, and how do you start them?
It is entirely about relationship building, and I think the most important thing to remember in that is that you have to listen. You certainly cannot go into a community and say, here's what I think you should do. Here's how you should improve the quality of your life. So we listen to what communities say are their most pressing problems, what relates to their local economy, what is it that they can do that they will feel that impact. So by listening, we find out that their most urgent needs are for their children so that they have a better future, and food. That's the most important thing. So finding a way to put food on the table right now and year-round. So building sustainable solutions so that eventually they no longer need funding from Coffee Kids.
Well, that's something I was going to ask you about. I mean, are the projects you do self-perpetuating, where people then just take them and run with it and, you know, maintain them, teach other people what they're doing and so on?
That's the idea. And that's also why we partner with local nonprofit organizations in those regions, because then they have the staff with the professional trainings to be able to teach the community members how the project works. So say it's a organic mushroom growing project, so there's a new source of food. So they teach them how to harvest those mushrooms, how to grow them themselves, and then help them maybe create their own enterprise so that they're selling these mushrooms to the other families in the community or other neighboring community members. And then it becomes, then eventually they can teach other people in the community or neighboring communities how to harvest those mushrooms, and they no longer need the training. But at the beginning, that is certainly quite critical, that there's consistent training and follow through with any of the projects, so that there's a real understanding of how the project works, and then people can, as you said, run with it themselves.
Have you seen, in the time that you've been doing it, and you've been involved with the organization for a while, real genuine change in the quality of people's lives due to these projects?
You know, you do see change, but you have to recognize that change is really slow, and so it's hard to measure sometimes. One of the things that we see as change are some of these non-economic changes, which is self-esteem for women who have lived maybe in oppressed communities for a long time where machismo is really quite common. So for a woman to say, I now have a voice in my own home, I can make a difference in my community. And for men to say, I've seen that you make a difference, and I want to learn what you're doing, and I would like to join the microcredit group myself. That's changing gender dynamics. And children are learning from their mothers by attending, say, the microcredit savings meetings that they attend every week. And children are starting to save money. So this is something that's very new, and it's creating an entirely new culture of saving and much more gender equity.
Is there a backlash against that?
We have not seen any backlash against that whatsoever. There's definitely
are the
resistance.
Men, the husbands, the brothers, and so on supportive?
They are now. At the beginning, there's certainly resistance. Unfortunately, what the women will face when they're first maybe going to join a microcredit group is, well, you know, what are a bunch of women going to do? Or you're just going off to gossip, or you're clearly having an affair. You know, really sort of standard replies, and there's not a lot of support. Fortunately, there's enough women who resist that, and they start going to the meetings, they start saving money, because the essential component to this microcredit project is that they are required to save, to demonstrate that they're capable of saving before taking out a loan, which might be $50. And the savings is something that might be 25 or 50 cents a week. So they start saving money, they take out a loan, they expand or start their small business, and the family sees that impact, and then the men have to recognize that they are eating better and they do have more consistent income. And so, as you mentioned before, the idea is that that way they can stay at home on their farms and continue to harvest their coffee even when prices are low, even if there's a drought or a flood. So the idea is to continue harvesting coffee, but to have supplemental and year-round income.
We're talking to Carolyn Fairman, who's the director of the organization Coffee Kids. Now, the land that people are growing coffee on, does that tend to be locally owned by the people you're talking to, or is it plantations owned by great big coffee companies and these are just employed labor?
Well, it's really varied. There's a little bit of everything. Most of the world's coffee farmers are small-scale coffee farmers, so they just have their own small piece of land.
So they do own their own land.
Yes. But in many regions, women are not allowed to own land. So if there's a crisis and there's out-migration so that a man has to go to the big city or cross the border to try to get a job to send money home, the farm gets abandoned. And because it's also an incredibly labor-intensive crop. And if the woman has no recourse because she doesn't own the land, it could get taken away from her.
So you said something a moment ago that struck me. You said people need food and they want a better future for their children. That's something that everybody always says, a better future for our children. What does that mean? What are they talking about? Are they talking about letting them go off to the big city? Are they talking about what do they envision as that future?
Well, the way that, for example, the scholarship program works that we support, when we have a scholarship program in Nicaragua and one in Costa Rica, it allows children to continue to go to school And it also provides scholarships for high school and university and technical students. And what that means is they learn a skill that they can bring back to their community. So they might become teachers or agronomists or even economists, and it's something that they can come back, live in their community, and help kind of bring their community more into present time and meet present needs. And so the idea is not that they go to the big cities and stay there and leave their communities. They do come back. And many of these coffee farming families are also members of coffee cooperatives. So another way that they give back is by working with their cooperative. And so it provides jobs. They might create ecotourism, which is something that we're seeing a lot, particularly in Nicaragua and Costa Rica. And that brings more money into the local economy and, again, creates jobs.
Now, you are... among other things, taking people, taking Americans on trips to some of these coffee-growing areas.
We are. This is a new thing that we've been doing that we started this past year, and it's really incredible. One of the things that I've seen when I've brought, say, longtime supporters, donors to Coffee Kids to what's called trips to origin, and origin is where coffee is grown, to see firsthand not only how labor-intensive coffee is, but what these realities of life are for coffee farming families, what they're facing on a daily basis. What is the level of poverty? What is the difference when there's a Coffee Kids project in place? Or what is the difference if they're selling fair trade coffee or members of a democratically run cooperative? And what they'll see is that these communities, these families that have all of the support are still poor. There's still poverty. So it's a long road ahead. But the impact to see that firsthand is something that's almost indescribable. You can show people photos, you can talk to them about it, but to really experience it and have the opportunity to talk one-on-one with a coffee farmer or with his children and learn about what the difference is because now they have a chicken raising project and they have food every day and maybe even meat every day. Has a really powerful impact. So we have taken several donors on trips, and we do two kinds of trips. One is a donor-arranged trip where, say, recently we took folks from S&D Coffee, which is a large coffee company based in North Carolina, to Nicaragua. So we arranged a special trip with them, and there was, I think, five or six executives from that coffee company to come down and see the project so they can see the impact that their funding is having for Coffee Kids and continue to support our work. We also have...
just to stop, hold you there for a second, it was very interesting. You and I were talking about this the other day. You bring people from this coffee company down to Nicaragua, and they remember the 80s when Ronald Reagan was trying to destroy the Sandinistas, and then they see that Daniel Ortega has been elected again, and they said, well, hang on, I thought the Sandinistas were the bad guys.
Right. This is what's also very interesting. You know, our work is not overtly political, but there's always politics involved when you're talking about poverty. And Daniel Ortega represents the poorest of the poor, and this is what anyone in Nicaragua will tell you. And the coffee farmers are the poorest of the poor. And what many people also don't realize is that Nicaragua is the second poorest country in this hemisphere after Haiti. So it is a very impoverished country. And so, yeah, we have some folks who maybe grew up thinking that the Contras were good and the Sandinistas were bad, and everyone has maybe their opinion and their history on that. So for people who are maybe afraid of the Sandinistas or learned to be afraid of them, to meet them face to face and realize that they're just people who want a better life for themselves and are just struggling to survive and didn't necessarily choose to take up arms but had no choice and had nothing left to lose, because when you're hungry and your farm's being taken away from you, you don't have anything left to lose, and you have fewer choices. So they were very thrilled to have Daniel Ortega back in the presidential seat as their hope.
And so here are these people from North Carolina looking at this. I mean, do you see when people go on trips like that, that their political opinion or set of ideas opens up a little bit?
A little bit. Not always. Some people will speak up about their fears a little bit, but maybe not... be able to confront them directly. A couple of the folks were fantastic in terms of really asking questions to try to learn more about why the Sandinistas were so popular in the uprising in 79, why they were excited about Daniel Ortega being president again, and what that was going to mean for them, and have a real dialogue about it and really listen and try to understand. where these people are coming from. We had one meeting of a women's microcredit group who all the women were also members of the what's called the women or the wives and mothers of the heroes, which means they're all women who lost a loved one in the Contra War in the 80s. And they have photos of their husbands and their children and their brothers, and they're very willing and wanting to talk about that history. So it was an opportunity for these people to really learn about that history a little bit more, why the coffee farmers are the poorest of the poor, and learn maybe not to be so afraid.
We're talking to Carolyn Fairman. Now there's a film on PBS that is airing, I guess you'd call it, this Saturday, the 14th of April at 10 at night. It's called Black Gold. What's it about?
This is a documentary that follows a man from Ethiopia named Tedesse Maskela, and he represents about 70,000 coffee farmers in Ethiopia, and he's trying to find a better price, a better market, for all of these coffee farmers. Again, I've mentioned that coffee is a very labor-intensive crop. It's not year-round, and people do need to earn more money for that crop. This is one of the only crops or any kind of consumer good that the buyer sets the price. It's based on the world market price. So this follows Tedesse as he goes to the New York Stock Exchange, and he goes to Seattle, and he goes to London. He goes to the World Trade Organization and learns about what these goings-on are and how this affects these coffee farmers that he represents back in Ethiopia, and how they need to get not only a better price for their coffee, but as I would say, they also need alternatives to coffee. So it's really an amazing film and gives you a lot of insight into what these realities are for coffee farmers. And what I would say is, while a better price is important, it's not enough. There is no one single solution to this problem. And I think if we work together and we recognize that there are a lot of people trying to make a difference for coffee farmers and work together and maybe look at better prices, look at alternatives, look at what the different specialty coffees are and organics and shade grown and bird friendly, and that is all worthwhile, and pay attention to that. So I would really highly recommend that you watch this film. Again, it's Saturday, April 14th at 10 p.m. on public television. And
for those of you staying home on Saturday night,
I know. I'm
looking for something to do. What do you think is the most effective program that Coffee Kids has done so far?
That's a hard question. I think that they're all effective in their own way. I mean, I think that a family that has started, say, a chicken raising project, and they now have their own source of organic meat and eggs and can sell the surplus, that's a huge success for that family and for that community. The microcredit has been incredibly successful because, for example, in Veracruz, in 1995, we began working with this organization in Veracruz and started with maybe about 100 women participating in the microcredit groups, and they hadn't saved any money yet. And today, there are over 2,000 participants, which include men and children, and they've saved collectively, and remember, this is an average of about 50 cents a week, over $700,000. So what happens is they create their own loan fund, and they no longer need money from Coffee Kids.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I've lived off and on in Latin America, and I've found a real antipathy to saving money. I mean, whenever anybody gets money, it seems that they go out immediately and spend it. And I once asked somebody, I said, why do you do that? Why don't you save it? And they said, because we live in a world where anything can happen at any day. There can be tremendous inflation, so that, you know, the dollar or peso or whatever in my hand right now might not be worth anything tomorrow. So better to spend it. So savings really is based on this idea that there's going to be some political economic stability.
Well, saving for these communities, you know, I've listened to women in rural Huatusco, Veracruz, Mexico say it calms the nerves. It's made an entirely immeasurable difference in my life to know that if my child gets sick, I don't have to abandon my farm, you know, potential. What can happen is something as simple as a child getting sick is it means losing a day's wages by going to the nearest clinic, which may be a day's trip away. And that costs money to take the bus to get into town. It costs money to pay the doctor, and it costs money to get medicine. And that can put a family into debt and mean out migration and completely break up a family. So by having some savings, they can cover the cost of the medications or that trip to the doctor if that's what's necessary, and then families can stay together. So it's you know, the, some of the issues are not the same that we think about here
right.
in the United States.
We've got just a few seconds left, but you are going to be giving away a trip, one of these trips that we're talking about to the coffee lands, to Costa Rica.
We are. I'm so glad you mentioned that. So you have an opportunity. Anyone can go on these trips to visit Coffee Kids Projects and also to learn about the coffee process. So you'll see this from seed to cup, how coffee is harvested. And it's a process that's something like 23 steps from seed to cup. So it's very interesting. You'll also meet with scholarship recipients that Coffee Kids supports. So anyone, first of all, can sign up for this trip. It's going to be in November. The dates right now are the 6th through the 12th. That could change by a day or two. But you can also win a trip, all expenses paid.
So there's a raffle?
We're having a drawing.
A drawing.
And so it's a suggested donation of $25. And if you're interested, please you can go to our website, and on the if you want to donate there, on the comment section, you can mention that it's for the drawing for the trip to Costa Rica, or please give us a call.
So the website is coffeekids.org, and the phone number is 820-1443. Carolyn Fairman, thank you so much for being with us and talking about Coffee Kids.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
This is the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And by the way, we are podcasting now. Today is our very first day. We've got a few weeks of shows already up. You can go to santafe.radiocafe.org and you can listen to the program. You can download it any time of day. So even if you are not by in your car or by your radio from 8 to 9, you can listen to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. So that's at santafe.radiocafe.org, made possible by Dotfoil Computer Services right here in Santa Fe. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.